You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eugene Linden has been traveling all over the world for the past 40 years, and the articles that he has written for Time and National Geographic about the most remote and unexplored parts of the world are the basis of his most recent book, The Ragged Edge of the World. In it, he explores the ways globalization has changed those untouched locations. The book is published by Viking. I'm very pleased it has brought Eugene Linden to our show today. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
And I was wondering about how this whole thing got started. What was the first assignment you were given?
Well, the first assignment that took me outside the United States was I broke a big story on fragging in Vietnam, which was when enlisted men turned on their officers, and this is towards the end of the war. And I was intrigued because, you know, all wars have had fraggings with an incompetent officer at the front lines, but most of the fraggings were in the rear echelon. And to me, that formed a basis of what was wrong with this war. Why were enlisted men trying to kill their officers? And that sent me to Vietnam, and I went around the world in the process.
But you were going as a war correspondent, very different from how your career has proceeded since. Nowadays, you would have gone to speak to the Vietnamese.
Right. And in fact, I did go back in the mid-90s to an area in the what used to be North Vietnam, in the that cordillera that divides Laos and Vietnam, a very remote area called Vu Quang, where they discovered a whole lot of new species of animal, large animals, like over 100 pounds, 200-pound animals that have been unknown to science. And it seemed extraordinary in this crowded world that there'd still be places like that.
Can the people there still maintain old cultural traditions?
Certainly, some of the tribes do.
There are still tribes even in a communist country like Vietnam?
Yes, but up in the hinterland, you know, they're not really assimilated or haven't been. They're still hunters. And an anthropologist went by and saw these horns outside a hut of a hunter, and you know, he knew all that. He was a biologist as well, and knew all this stuff, and didn't recognize it turned out to be a new species. So there are these pockets around the world where indigenous tribes persist, but they're fewer and fewer, and they're more under pressure.
Well, they're under pressure just because of the way the world is proceeding, but also I would think in some countries under pressure because of the government policy.
Of course.
For example, in China, where there are so many different dialects, the pressure has been for many years for everybody to speak Mandarin.
Right. Well, that's one of the tensions is that in the cause of progress and development for these people, you end up killing their culture. In New Guinea, for instance, which you were just talking about, Father Frank Mihalik codified a language called Pidgin, which became the unifying language in New Guinea, and there's about 700 or 800 languages spoken. Now some of those languages are dying out, and with them the culture and all the knowledge that's embodied in that culture. So you're always caught in that tension, and even with the best of intentions, and Frank Mihalik is as close to a saint as anyone I ever met, you know, you can do harm in the cause of progress.
But you say in New Guinea the ancient belief systems have been assimilating modernity.
No, they were brilliant.
Is that a way to keep them going?
Yeah, I think it does at a deep level. I mean, they love consumer goods, but the convenient answer is that those bumbling Europeans didn't make these consumer goods. The ancestors made the consumer goods, and the Europeans stole them from them. And so while it's amusing, it also can be dangerous because the New Guineans can react quite violently to theft.
You also say that even in the most remote parts of the world, there people are aware of pop culture and trends.
Of course. And
New Guinea?
Not so much in the real hinterland, but certainly in Port Moresby and other places. But, you know, and I did a cover story some years back for Time called Lost Tribes, Lost Knowledge. And on the cover was a New Guinean tribesman with a sweetheart straw through his nose. So, and, you know, I was in Borneo, and the last hunting and gathering tribes up there are called the Penan. And one of the things that got me going on this project was that I'd heard a story about how the hunters and gatherers would hunt the boar by watching for the arrival of a particular fast-moving butterfly. Well, I went up to the highlands, and sure enough, there were met with a bunch of tribal elders, and they got all excited and talking about this butterfly and how it arrived. Now, from an ecological point of view, that's very interesting because it probably means there's some coordination between the fruiting season of what the butterfly larvae are eating and when the boar arrive. But from their point of view, it's knowledge of the forest, right? Well, then I went down to Miri, where the sons of some of these tribal elders were in school, and I'd asked them if they knew about the butterfly, and they looked at me like I had three heads. So that's how this knowledge disappears. I mean, silently and invisibly, but this generation that's in school is not going to know anything of what their elders knew.
But I'm assuming there's also a transitional phase. I remember the movie Crocodile Dundee, not necessarily the most realistic movie, but the Aborigines wear wristwatches and speak colloquially.
Right, and there is a bit of hope in something called deep culture. I was in Polynesia, and I was talking with Ben Finney, and you know, I call this the chapter "Polynesia Lost and Found," because while it's all the trappings of modernity have been enthusiastically adopted by the Tahitian, there's still Tahitian in their core reactions to things. And so Finney, who's an anthropologist, was arguing that as long as those embers of that deep culture persist, you can reconstitute some form of Polynesian culture. And that's what he did when he helped a bunch of Polynesians navigate between Hawaii and Tahiti.
So you're saying philosophically there are certain underpinnings, or is this through the religion?
I think it's a worldview, and it's not so much
because
religion.
They're all Christian. Like Westerners, and they're all Christianized.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The word is overused, but I call it a silent Holocaust. And I'll give you an example. I was in a place in the heart of Equator in the Congo in what was used to be called Zaire. And the missions were telling me that they had a lot of problems with medicine, a lot of problems where people had forgotten their healing traditions. And they were getting the doses wrong, and they were getting the applications wrong, and so they were hurting rather than healing. And so that's part of the transition as well, as a healer has a very hard time maintaining his specialness and authority when somebody come waltzing in with these extremely powerful medicines from the West that might do things that he can't do, for instance, or they come in a big Toyota and he's wandering around on a donkey.
On the other hand, we have learned that some of the traditional medicines in the Amazon and elsewhere are quite effective, and in some cases we've found what the secret ingredient is and try to apply them in Western medicine.
Yeah, and I had my own experiences with this.
But we approach these people as though we know everything and they don't know anything.
Well, that's right. And that carries over to the people themselves. I mean, Frank Mihalik was telling me, or Father Mihalik was saying that, you know, the least attended course at his college on the north coast of New Guinea was one where he tried to teach them about the traditions of their culture. They were embarrassed by these traditions. So sometimes it's hard to even get the people themselves to realize how valuable it is what they know.
My guest is Eugene Linden, who's the author of 9 books, the most recent, The Ragged Edge of the World, Encounters at the Frontier, Where Modernity, Wildlands, and Indigenous Peoples Meet. It's published by Viking. And you call your book A Farewell Tour of the Most Remote Corners of the World and an Elegy for What Has Been Lost. Is there any place where people are holding out?
Yes, and there's one 90 miles from our shore, and they're holding out involuntarily. But Cuba, for instance, close to one of the hyperpower of the world, has been politically isolated for 50 years, and you go there, and it's like seeing the Caribbean of 50 or 60 years ago. And by accident and one piece of luck, they've been forced to kind of live a sustainable existence, less reliant on fossil fuels, et cetera, greener agriculture. And
old Chevrolets.
And wonderful old cars. Now, I'm no apologist, for it's a dictatorship and it's a repressive regime. And indeed, in the rest of the world, communism has been a disaster for the environment. It seems like it's an economic system that converts resources into pollution with very little economic benefit. But in Cuba, it turned out that one of Castro's top saviors, actually, during the revolution, turned out to be a nature lover. And he provided political cover for a whole generation of conservationists. So it now has – it's in much better ecological shape than it was 20 years ago and even 40 years ago.
Conservation was forced on them.
It was forced on them, but they also because of this one commandante who allowed to be educated a whole generation of ecologists and environmentalists, they seem to be one of the few nations on the planet that took the Earth Summit of the early 90s seriously.
We'll take a little break and come back with more from Eugene Linden, his book, The Ragged Edge of the World, Encounters at the Frontier, Where Modernity, Wildlands, and Indigenous Peoples Meet. It's published by Viking. We're back with Eugene Linden, his book, The Ragged Edge of the World, Encounters at the Frontier, Where Modernity, Wildlands, and Indigenous Peoples Meet. It's published by Viking. Your travel began before the internet exploded. How has access to the World Wide Web accelerated globalization?
Well, it any place you can get a cell phone now, you can find out about things that you might not find out about before. So, of course, it's had an enormous impact. In some countries like Zaire, for instance, there was a theory that Mobutu purposely allowed the infrastructure to deteriorate and allowed and the telephones and everything else not to work, so nobody could organize opposition to him. So it's also the cell phone has changed all that, and as we've seen in the Middle East in recent months, that's exactly one of the mediums that's allowed people to go around their autocratic leaders.
Well, the first thought is that globalization has a downside always, but you're suggesting it also has a positive side.
I am, but I think the phrase that sums it up for me is individual brilliance and collective stupidity. Because if you look at where we're going in the broad macro sense, we're heading off a cliff. And yet the incentives are such that we, for individuals, that we will continue to try and do the things that are basically going to force us off the cliff until we actually head off. And it really, we've reached a point, on this planet where you really can't toss anything away without it landing on somebody's head. And I was out in the middle of the Pacific in Midway Island, and about as remote from land as any place you can get. And it's right in the middle of what's called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And so all that plastic from everywhere else on Earth is collected there, and it's a threat to the albatross who live there. And I was up in northern Yakutia and in Russia. Again, about as far from industry as you could imagine. And because the air currents gather the toxins and concentrate them in what's called the Arctic front up north, and they then fall out as snow and go into the water table, these tribes up there, the Chukots and others, would have concentrations of heavy metals as though they were working next to a nickel factory. So you can't escape.
And we're seeing the same thing in the Amazon. There was a time when people could just go deeper and deeper into the forest.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't seem to be possible. The gold mining, among other things, and the ranching and the Amazon has changed things there. But wasn't there also the appeal of the steel axe? If you have stone axes, even if you don't really want to have anything to do with the outside world, you realize that that steel axe is a lot more effective.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's it's irresistible and it's hard to argue against. When I was with the Penans, they use blowguns and they make the poisons and everything else. And they all said, well, we like using the blowgun. But then later some of the outsiders and leaders were telling me if they could get their hands on a gun and do the hunting with a gun, they would. And the thing is that what you learn as you go around these places is almost anything is sustainable on a very small scale. Almost anything is unsustainable on a very large scale. And that's the problem, is that they carry with them a culture that says, I can't hurt this forest. And that was what the pygmies would tell me. But they couldn't conceive that logging, might destroy the forest, which is their resource base.
Don't we also tend to exoticize these people? We want them to be purer than they necessarily want to be?
Yes, but that's absolutely right. But on the other hand, there aren't going to be any of them left. We may want them to be pure, but they're not going to be pure.
Well, we want them to be authentic.
Well,
and then, and they're also thinking about their own lives and their own comforts and the things that will make their lives better.
Right. And they, most of the time, what my experience and observations have been that It's the comfortable life, the middle class life, is not available to them, and so they end up halfway between, neither unable to go back to their own tribal way of life, and even forgetting it, and unable to fit within the modern market economy.
You mention a lot of visitors to Machu Picchu play at channeling their inner Inca warrior.
Right.
And I wonder what the locals think of that.
Oh, I imagine they go home and collapse in laughter.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, you'd be standing, and it's one of the most dramatic settings on the planet. I could see why the Incas wanted to take that as and set it up as a religious place. But the esotericas, as they're called down there, come in from all over the world and think that it's set on top of a giant crystal. And so that there are all these rituals going on at every point of the day and people talking about their past lives as an ordinary course of conversation. And then they must have a very strange idea of what Europeans and Americans are like when, for those who live there and see this constant influx of people looking for their inner crystal.
But there are people who have made it their mission to preserve ancient cultures, preserve ancient languages. But is it your sense that in the end it's all gonna merge together and there'll just be one world culture with a few variations within?
I hope not, but it's certainly that's the direction we're headed. And the momentum of this is just astonishing. As you pointed out earlier, it's very hard to say use a stone axe if a metal axe is there. And what comes with that metal axe? Well, half the time the people don't realize that, you know, the Faustian bargain they're making when they begin to accept the conveniences of modern life. And when they try to get them back, it's often too late. Now, I've seen some success stories in that regard because what happens, Western medicine is a great example, a very powerful tool, but it is so much more expensive than anything an impoverished community in Central Africa can afford. And so you have, in one case, a fellow named Bernard Ndanazi in the Central African Republic who was trained as a Western medical technician, and he remembered what he'd been taught about healing arts when he was growing up, and he realized that his people couldn't afford the Western medicine. He said, this stuff works. And in one very dramatic example, a patient came to him whose chest had been eaten open by some kind of infection and hadn't been able to be cured by the local mission hospital. He applied a poultice of crushed termites to the wound and healed the wound, and it was something he remembered when he was growing up. So there are these people who realize something precious is being lost. But what are we going to – we'll have this – end up with this homogenized world, and we'll lose not just what holds – the glue that holds these societies together and keeps down crime and prevents incest and all the other things that are the pathologies of a disenfranchised culture. But we'll also lose the knowledge that they have, and that's a tremendous resource for us.
Is it ironic that that's happening now? There was a time when it was the policies of governments, this country, Canada, Australia, others, mm-hmm. to assimilate all indigenous peoples and destroy their culture, force them to speak English in those cases, but it could just as easily be another language. And now when we recognize that that's probably – in fact, we've apologized mm-hmm. to most of those people. Now we want to save the culture after it's a little too late.
That's exactly right. And it – you know, we
– Well, so can we avoid homogenization?
I don't think we can. You go up to northern Canada and people say they're going to their indigenous hunting ground. And in one case, they were taking helicopters to go there. Now, you know, that's the kind of lifestyle an orthodontist in Texas might enjoy, and going to his traditional hunting ground. But it's not what held that tribe together. And so I think it's going to be very difficult. Just the power of ideas and images of the power of the West. You know, the first thing you see is, you may see the bad side within if you're at the ragged edge. But then you see the good side and the conveniences. And you do this argument over and over again. And this is what, you know, I'm old enough that my experiences out there are kind of an index of change. And so I'm hearing whenever I go out there to this ragged edge the same kinds of things I was hearing 40 years ago. You can't stop progress. You know, these people need these things. And yet, and it doesn't matter what government policy is at this point, as you point out.
Well, is it a lot more dangerous for you when you started? Because I'd imagine at one point there were people who had never seen an outsider, white person or whatever, before, and that would be seen as a danger. Today, everybody has seen everybody.
It's more dangerous now in a lot of respects than it was when I was first traveling, just because crime has invaded areas where you would feel totally safe before. I do remember in one of my first trips to Africa, crime was so rampant in this country, it was Lesotho, that I slept with a pistol under my pillow for a couple of weeks, and I haven't had to do that for a long time.
But you never had to use it. Yeah.
But you know what you find is, I was in this in Ecuador, and I was stuck there for some time. I was talking to one of the local missionaries, and he was telling me about how justice was meted out in the town. At that point, some woman had been raped, and the family wanted justice, so they went to the constabulary and they said, "Well, how much is it worth to you for us to go after the rapist?" And they negotiated a price. Then they went to the rapist's house and they said, "Well, they bid this. And how much is it worth to you for us not to arrest your son for rape?" And the bidding was going on. And I was thinking, God, that is, you know, a perfect example of corruption in Africa. But then you think, what's going on with the financial crisis here? It's essentially, you know, who's going to jail for this? It's essentially a bidding war, just like it is in Central Africa.
Were there areas that you would have liked to have traveled to but couldn't?
Yeah, I mean, at different points.
Well, there are wars that go on, but also there are governments that won't let foreigners in.
Right.
If you'd wanted to go to Burma, most of the time it has been foreigners haven't been allowed.
That's right. But wait long enough, you can go anywhere. I mean, if now you can go into Burma, and there's tours going into Burma to look at the wildlife. The places that another of the ironies of all this is that war is a great destroyer of peoples and lands, but it's also a great protector of nature. In northern Suriname, or southern Suriname rather, there was an ongoing guerrilla war, low-level guerrilla war with a group called the Maroons that basically kept people out of there, and I encountered some of the most naive animals on the planet. Nicaragua, during the Civil War, the forests weren't being cut. Now, as soon as the Civil War is over, they're very busily cutting them again. Same thing in Vietnam. So there are all these things. I mean, you pointed out that policy to assimilate the tribes, once it reversed, the tribes still became assimilated. Then quite often things happen independently of policy. And for instance, for years, there was very little action on population, you know, because what birth rates would stay the same and death rates would go down, and you have exploding populations, which leads to impoverishment in much of the world. We'll try to do something about that. The most effective form of population control that I've seen is urbanization, because as soon as a family moves from the hinterland to the city, extra kids become a burden rather than a resource, and they seek out birth control and ways of having fewer children. And that's done more than a 1,000 think tanks.
Do you suggest any things that we might do to stop this trend?
Yes. At the end of the book, I originally wrote this with Tom Lovejoy and Dan Phillips, Ambassador to the Congo, for Foreign Affairs. I propose a way at which you could achieve continental scale conservation, based on free market principles, actually. I can't go into all the details now, but I think, you know, that's just my idea. I welcome other ideas. Attitudes can change very rapidly as circumstances change. And if we'll take climate change, for instance, for 30 years we've done nothing. The recession has done more to help people achieve the Kyoto goals than anything, any policy in any part of the world. But as the effects of climate change become more and more obvious, I think there will be a sea change in attitudes. And there are things where consumers, who are 70% of the economy, can, just by making their own choices, affect change at a global level.
Although it's been pointed out that once the process has begun, it's hard to reverse it. All you can do, perhaps, is slow it down.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, we may already be in a transition, in which case we're going to, you know, have to ride the rapids. But we can also stop making it worse.
Eugene Linden's book, published by Viking, is called The Ragged Edge of the World, Encounters at the Frontier, where modernity, wild lands, and indigenous peoples meet. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.